Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location, broadcasting the latest on health and environmental issues. And because there's a Category 4 storm hitting Alabama, Mississippi, and mainly Florida, and the people are not prepared for this, we're going to do more on the environment than normally. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. And we also have a guest today also talking about the environment and why we have to be more realistic. And that guest is Charles Eisenstein. And we're going to talk about the new climate story, changing the narrative to confront our environmental threats. Charles is an independent scholar. He's a counterculture speaker and an authority. He writes about human culture and identity and economics and the evolution of humans and the spiritual challenges of coping with a society and world in chaos. He's taught at Goddard College, Penn State University. He also lived in China. He holds degrees in mathematics, philosophy from Yale University, and has been active with other visionaries to develop progressive models to be sustainable. His most recent book is Climate, A New Story. So he'll be on in about a half hour from now. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, and it's about the exposure to common flame retardants, and that can contribute to attention problems in children. Prenatal exposure to some flame retardants that have been widely used in consumer products is associated with an attention problem in children, generally through ages 3 through 7. That's according to the latest report. Now, that's showing the degree that it's impacting. Who would have thought that a flame retardant in a mattress, in a blanket, in crib material, in your daily household, like curtains and rugs, and even in some particle boards that are made into desks and cabinets, that would vaporize, and you wouldn't smell it, but you would breathe it in tiny nanoparticles, and it would then go through the mother system into the developing fetus. And then when the baby is born, they're exposed to this, and that then causes irritation and inflammation in the brain, which causes hyperactive, all kinds of activities. So what do we do? Well, what we should do is we should detoxify. Breast milk is the best single way of building up the natural immune system of the baby. Once they've been weaned at a year to 2 years of age, then let's start incorporating some of the natural detoxificants like green vegetables, like spinach and celery. And you can combine that with some apple, so it's pleasant to the taste. And almost all of our tastes are acquired. And that's why I posted recently on my Facebook about a 3 to 4 minute montage of children spitting out, hating, crying, going into temper tantrums when they were asked to eat a vegetable. It was not something they wanted to do. Well, where did that come from? It came from them being weaned on junk foods, eating French fries, potato chips. Now you want to eat some broccoli? It's how you guide the child in their choice selections and making food fun. But that green will help detoxify. And when the child can tolerate vitamin C, it's a natural chelator. It's good for them as well. So natural chelation with chlorophyll-rich fruits and vegetables, and then vitamin C. From the Brigham and Women's Hospital, biomolecules in human breast milk stop inflammation. Human breast milk, which provides essential nutrients and antibodies to newcomers in this world, has long been known to play an important role in infant development and the immune system. This new study, published in Mucosal Immunology, researchers from Brigham and Women's Hospital report that human breast milk serves as a reservoir for biomolecules that help to resolve inflammation and combat infection. Quote, finding a reservoir of these inflammatory resolving molecules at bioactive levels was a big surprise for us. That's good. One more reason to breastfeed. You're helping wounds to heal, natural immunity to be developed, because every time the mother kisses the baby, she takes mucus from the baby's lips. Her own body then develops antibodies to any bacteria or any other foreign agent that's in the child's undeveloped immune system. She then produces an antibody, and that is given to the baby through her breast milk. So every time you breastfeed, you're naturally immunizing your baby. No formula can do that. There's a nutrient that was very popular about 10 years ago. It was called NAC. N-acetyl, cysteine, C-Y-S-T-E-I-N. So N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, can reduce levels of homocysteine and improve blood pressure. And this was through two randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials and published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. This was done at the University of Marburg, which is in Germany. Now, when you realize that homocysteine is a silent killer, you can't feel it, and most people don't know that they even have such a thing as homocysteine produced by the liver, which is it's an inflammatory marker. Now, when it's in the low range, that's fine. But when you start getting it up to 13, 14, 15, or 16, you really increase your risk of a heart attack or stroke and even cancer. And here's the problem. These blood thinners that people take every day by the millions, that thins the blood. That's good. It also kills about 24,000 minimally a year because of bleeding. That's bad. But then they also destroy your vitamin C, folic acid, B6, and B12. Those four nutrients are necessary to keep your homocysteine levels down so you don't have a heart attack. So on the one hand, cardiologists will allow you to have less stroke, but more heart attacks. Doesn't make any sense, does it? So just remember, the reason you take an aspirin is because it thins the blood. Vitamin E thins the blood but doesn't kill you, helps you. Coenzyme Q10 does the same. Garlic, onions do the same. Vitamin C is a really good blood thinner. And yet that all lowers the homocysteine levels. So if you haven't had your homocysteine levels checked and C-reactive protein and fibrinogen and triglycerides, do so. It's very important that you know that when there are an increased level, you have an increased risk of heart disease. Also, carrots do help aging eyes. This is the University of Utah School of Medicine. So when you heard, as I did and I'm sure you did, from your parents, eat your carrots, they're good for your eyes, they were right. Because it's a pigment called carotenoids, which give red or orange hues to carrots and sweet potatoes and orange peppers and deep greens to produce like spinach and broccoli and kale. And that helps ward off age-linked vision ailment known as macular degeneration. And that is important. So when you have a glass of vegetable juice each day and you have carrots in there and beets and sweet potato and radishes, you're doing a lot of good. Because in those carotenoids, rich foods, including broccoli and kale and spinach, you have what is called zeaxanthin, which is Zeaxanthin. And that is really important for vision. Also lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N. The two together concentrate in the macula. And the macula, macula, M-A-C-U-L-A, that's where you're protected from damage from oxygen and light or oxidative stress to the eyes. Also, I mentioned the other day that the coffee bean, not coffee, had powerful nutrients, including pain-killing nutrients. And you can get the tablets made from the green organic coffee bean. This is from the University of Brasilia, which is in Brazil. And it shows that that's absolutely correct, that they have found that this helps as a natural painkiller. So, and it's analogous to the proteins that you would find being arranged in the body, which are natural opiate peptides. And so have the green coffee bean tablet and have more pain relief. And finally today, talking about health, metabolic syndrome, that's where you're overweight and have generally abdominal weight, your belly fat, and that leads to diabetes and heart disease. 1 in 3 Americans needs more vitamin E, because if you have these conditions, you're going to be vitamin E deficient, according to Ohio State University. So get your vitamin E. I suggest a natural vitamin E, where you get all four of your most important tocotrienols and tocopherols, alpha, beta, gamma, the good ones, and then have 400 units twice a day. And that'll help you with metabolic syndrome and gives your blood more oxygenation, and that's good. Also from the National Institute on Aging, obesity in midlife is linked to earlier onset of diabetes. So if you have that thick waistline, that can give you diabetes, heart disease, and joint problems, and stroke. So you want to get the weight off. That's why the older you get, the more you should be exercising. And you can help then prevent Alzheimer's. I'm Gary Nall, on location. We're going to take a brief break and come right back with some information on the environment. Please stay with us.
Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I want to spend a little more time today on environmental issues because for the first time in Florida's history, they're getting hit in the northern panhandle with a Category 4 storm. And it could get worse. Unfortunately, not everyone got out of harm's way. People were very casual about it, and they shouldn't have been. So I'm going to share some reasons why we should be very concerned about our environment. This is from Common Dreams. It says, what's not in the latest terrifying IPCC report? The much, much, much more terrifying new research on climate tipping points. Quote, this is the scariest thing about the report. It's the watered-down consensus version. If the latest warnings contained in this report by the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, that's IPCC, which include pronouncement that the world has less than 12 years to drastically alter course to avoid the worst impacts of human-caused global warming, and that nothing less then keeping all fossil fuels in the ground is the solution to avoid future calamities. Have you at all frightened or despondent? Experts respond to the report have a potentially unwelcome message for you already overburdened persons, and it's this. It's very likely even worse than you're being told. Quote, the IPCC report understates a key risk that self-reinforcing feedback loops could push the climate system into chaos before we have time to tame our energy systems. Mario Molino, Nobel laureate. After the report's publication, there were headlines like, we have 12 years to act on climate change before the world as we know it is lost. How much more urgent can it get? All kinds of reports. But as Jamie Henn, co-founder and program director for the International Climate Group 350.org, stated in a tweet yesterday, the scariest thing about the report is the fact that it's the watered-down consensus version. The latest science is much, much, much more terrifying. He was actually responding to Penn State University's climate scientist, Michael Mann, who was pushing back against those criticizing the report as too alarmist in its declaration and warning. If anything, Professor Mann declared, quote, it is the opposite. Once again, with their latest report, they have been overly conservative, erring on the side of underestimating the problem. Okay, that's that. Now, let me tell you what I think on this. 7 years ago, we had a full hour devoted to one guest, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona, Guy McPherson. In that hour, he laid out in very measured and methodical ways what would go wrong, what's going to go wrong, and what the likely outcome will be. No one believed him. They called him an alarmist. They actually engaged in environmental activist McCarthyism. They ganged up on him. He was so beleaguered and so upset, it cost him his family and his career, and he just left America and went down to Belize. And then I saw him on an Australian podcast, and for me, he was sarcastic. He was bitter, and he was not patient in the interview. And I thought, wow, there's a wounded person who is suffering. So 5 years ago, I invited him back, and he came back, and he said, it's just not global warming that we have to focus on. You have to focus on the acidification of the oceans, the bleaching of the coral reefs everywhere, the loss of snow on the great glaciers, including the Himalayan mountains, which feeds India and China and Vietnam and others, their water, all the seven great rivers in the world in that area, all are fed from the Himalayas. It's losing its water, and therefore it's drying out, will dry out. The desertification, where whole communities in China, 12,000 communities in China were virtually taken back to the desert. The desertification was so severe. Half of all the rivers in China are so polluted that they can't even be used for irrigation, let alone human use. The same is true in India. Together, you're dealing with 2.6 billion people. That's almost 40% of the entire world population. And yet, nothing is being done in a measurable way. And then he also talked about factory farming, our reliance upon meat as the protein in our diet instead of vegetable proteins. So he went through all these issues. Again, no one listened. And I remember saying the first time he was here, if we don't do everything we can, if we don't have a Marshall Plan to engage the entire world, not just America, but the whole world, in changing its habits, consumption habits, and its disposable and obsolescence habits, what's our timetable to where it goes beyond our capacity to reverse it? He said at that time, 13 years. Now, that was 7 years ago. 5 years ago, he said we had about 7 years to go based upon a new mathematical model that he was using. I then asked him, please come back. I'm doing a documentary on the environment, and it's the most definitive documentary that, to my knowledge, ever done in the world. We've been working on it for about 10 years. We put tens of thousands of hours into it. But because what we shot earlier, people were optimistic. They said, well, nothing's going to happen for 100 years. So what? Well, I'll be dead in 100 years, so who cares? And governments took that same position. Everybody had this kind of same idea. Don't worry. Nothing's going bad is going to happen. Today, Florida is going to get slammed with a Category 4. Now, I got a Category 4 12 months ago, and I want to tell you, it devastated everything on my ranch, my neighbors, and you can drive up the streets now, you still see all the houses with tarps on, mine included, because there's too much money to fix a roof, insurance is not covering the cost, and people have to wait, even if they could afford to fix a roof, a year, because there are too few roofers and too many damaged roofs. Now, that didn't make it up to the northern end of the state as a Category 4. It went way down, about halfway up the state. Now they're going to get hit today, as we speak, with a Category 4. It's never happened before in history. So there's going to be massive devastation because the ground up there is already saturated with water. There's no place for the water to go. When I moved to Florida 25 years ago to open up my animal sanctuary, one of the nicest places to live was in Marco Island because you had all these canals that you could take a boat right out to the Gulf. The Gulf was clean. There was no pollution. You go swimming. Not now. This week, Naples, Florida, had a report about it had all these dead fish, the most that had ever been seen in the history, on the beach, in the water. And they don't know why. Well, how about red algae? That's why. And we did the research, found that red algae goes almost 40 miles out. So the manatees are dying, porpoise and dolphins are dying, fish are dying. Nothing's being done about it because it's political. So everywhere you look, what Guy McPherson predicted has come true. The most rain in American history in one period of time, 21 trillion gallons over the Houston area, flooded everything, caused all those refineries to spill all that bellage of chemical toxins into the soil. The soil down there is clay, so it's nowhere to go. So people were breathing it, getting infections in their body, and yet nothing has changed. Last night in a lecture, and I've been doing lectures throughout the day. This morning I did one for an hour on, and this was interesting. I said, why do you believe that people were seeing for 5 days, people saw Hurricane Katrina coming at them at a Category 5. It didn't hit at 5 and veered slightly off course, which really saved New Orleans. But even a low Category 2 was enough to cause massive damage, 2,000 deaths, still not recovered. Why didn't they get out of harm's way? You hear every excuse in the world why they didn't get out. Why didn't people out in Long Island get out of Sandy's way, Hurricane Sandy? That was a Category 1. New York will ultimately get a Category 4 or 5. And within the next 2 years, I predict that we'll see the first Category 6. So it's coming. It's not science fiction. It's real. So here's a question for you. I'm going to ask my guest. Knowing that we're living in the wrong place at the wrong time, with that which in nature can destroy us, why don't we choose to move to a safer, more sustainable place? Why don't we get out of harm's way? Unfortunately, we don't. Everyone thinks they have time. The Buddha says, you have no more time. And we're seeing that today in Florida. So the report that they gave you is wrong. It's still ultra-conservative. Guy McPherson, 1 month ago, came to my office in New York, and I filmed him for between 2 and 3 hours. And he's given a whole new set of predictions. So with every prediction, we have our on-staff scholars match it against the prevailing scientific literature, and he's right again. So we can start to look at areas of the world no longer being sustainable right now. And the trouble is, if an area is still sustainable where a person lives, they tend to downplay the significance of these warnings as if it doesn't matter. It does. It really does. And you're going to see the largest migration, environmental migrants, in Africa than ever before in history. You could have it up to between 130 to 180 million initially, and then going to as high as 300 million. The entirety of the Middle East is non-sustainable. It's going through the worst drought ever. That is also true of the southern end of the Mediterranean, Greece, Crete, Spain, Portugal, and Italy are all going to be adversely affected. So I think it's time, when every headline in the world is telling us to pay attention, I think it's time that we paid attention. Not to do so is foolish. This is from Tim Radford. Fire and drought threaten China and Europe. Even if nations do limit global warming, fire and drought will remain threats, ravaging more harvest in China and setting more Europe ablaze. This is from Climate News Network. Quote, the most limited rise in global temperatures, never mind higher ones, is going to exact a price through fire and drought. Even assuming the world keeps its Paris promise to contain average planetary temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius. Well, it's not going to happen. A, the United States, which is the largest polluter in the world and uses more resources than any other country in the world, we're not going to limit ourselves. We're not going to close down industries. We're not going to have a Marshall Plan because we have a body politic divided. We have the corporate compromise politicians who will not stop companies from taking gas hydrofracking product and oil out of the ground or continue to use nuclear power. So we're going to get slammed starting now. That's just another. I have over 100 reports today just on the environment. But I'm going to save that for my guest in about 10 minutes. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. We have a lot of listeners in Florida. I mean a lot. I get a lot of emails from them, and they're always asking questions about the environment, what I think the future of Florida is. And I believe the future of Florida will be determined by the next major statewide hurricane, a hurricane. And if it's a Category 4 or 5, and we haven't recovered from this one, that'll be it. You'll see the greatest migration out of the state of Florida. Property values will just plummet everywhere. There won't be enough tax base to keep local communities going. There'll be bankruptcies galore. All it takes is one more. What today is a reminder that you can't take anything for granted. 3 days ago, nobody thought about this storm. Today, as we speak, it's beating over 1 million people. On the line now is Dr. Roy Spicer. He has a PhD in microbiology. He has had a long, distinguished career in water systems and water science. And what we are going to do from our part is to understand that the first thing that happens when you have a hurricane, fires, tornadoes, you lose power. When you lose power, your water pumps go out. You don't have water. You don't have potable water. What are you going to drink? You can't. And water is run out immediately. And in a storm, there's no way to get resupplied to water. And if the average person is using in America over 107 gallons a day, even in an emergency, you're going to need about 10 gallons, then you got trouble. So then people start to realize they were not prepared. But it's not just in Florida. It's not just when we see it. We all should be prepared because you never know when your community, we've seen flooding in Vermont, upstate New York, and towns that have never been flooded before. We've seen it in Wisconsin. We've seen it in Indiana. They weren't prepared. In Georgia, they weren't prepared. So I'm suggesting we get prepared. If nothing else, have yourself always ready, stored food, where you have food that you know if nothing happens, not food you have to cook because you may not have any power, may not have any gas or propane or electric, but food that you could eat, like cans of beans, that would be fine. And this way, you'll be able to survive. You can go a while without food. You can't go without water. So we're offering our audience today one of the most unique water filters you've ever seen. It's stainless steel. It's the 1.5 gallon emergency portable water filter. And there's a good sale on it also today. And what is it? Well, there's a unique concept in this water filter that's unlike anything else that you've ever seen. It's the new ceramic, what is called Metalgon, M-E-T-A-L, metal, gon, G-O-N. And it removes bacteria, parasites, toxic chemicals, fluoride, and a wide range of heavy metals. And a lot of that you're going to get in any flood water. It produces safe, clean drinking water from any source. It's called the Gary Nall Emergency Water Filter. And the unit is designed for use after natural disasters, where potable water is not available. And also, this unit can be utilized for daily drinking water in your home. And the water filter uses state-of-the-art ceramic microfiltration with Metalgon filter material for reducing a wide range of toxic contaminants in drinking water. So the combined filter technologies efficiently removes bacteria, removes parasites, removes chloramine, chemicals, sediment, debris, turbidity, bad taste and odor. There's no other filter that I'm aware of that does this. And it uses gravity to push water through the filters to supply thousands of gallons of clean, safe drinking water from any freshwater source, even your swimming pool you could use. The water is then stored in the lower chamber ready for use, and the tap is provided to draw filtered water. The unit can hold up to 1.5 gallons at a time in the top and lower chambers for continued use. And each Gary Nall emergency water filter provides you with the ultimate protection that you and your family need. You should always have it. And that way if you put it in your car and you get stuck in traffic and and this has happened. So many people leave a place at the same time, people run out of gas. People aren't topped off with their gas, meaning once you have no more room for gas, if you gently squeeze, you can get another gallon or two. And if you're getting 30 miles to a gallon, that could get you anywhere from 30 to 60 more miles. But unfortunately, most people are not prepared for anything in life. As a result, they run out of gas. Who knew there was going to be a storm? They didn't have any stored food. Well, I didn't know. And they have no water to drink. And the stores are all empty. That's reality. Happened in New York City. In fact, I actually brought in a tractor trailer of food. And I asked people in my audience, and it was all based upon trust. and we had all of these Haitian cab drivers pull up to my office, and we loaded them up every morning with food and water and sent them downtown to give it as a gift to those in lower Manhattan who had no power, no electricity, and it helped a lot of people, thousands of people. But even my own neighbors that I say, you know, I have backup systems. My house is solar powered. I have my own wells. I have my own backup generators. I have a backup to that and elevated so nothing floods it. And I have at least a 3-year supply of food in different forms. They don't have anything. After the storm a year ago, I walked across the street and there was an elderly couple and they were sitting out in lawn chairs, boiling hot, very humid, mosquitoes everywhere. And I said, do you have any food? Do you have water? Can I help you? Oh, we're okay. They had some sandwiches. Didn't have water. And I'm thinking, wow, even when you want to help people, they frequently are too proud to accept help. We should be prepared for any emergency all the time. Roy, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Gary.
We only have a few minutes because I have to go to my guest here. Roy, tell people why it's so important that they not be cavalier or indifferent or suffer from hubris and think, I don't need a water filter. Everyone needs, in America, a backup system, a plan B, because you never know where crisis is going to happen, fire, earthquake, tornadoes, hurricanes, and they are clueless what to do, and water is not available to drink.
We're dealing with that right now in the post-disaster in North and South Carolina. We've had numerous calls, people trying to get back in their homes, and when they get there, they don't have potable water because the treatment systems still aren't up and running. So this is weeks after the flooding, and it's still flooding up there, and unfortunately, I think they're going to get more water from this storm. So this could last for months, and our experiences and your experience over the last 6 years, going back to Hurricane Sandy, is that you may not have potable water for weeks to months. And even if you store water for an emergency, how many gallons can you store? You may need hundreds or, like you said, 1,000 gallons of water over a period of weeks and months, and that's just drinking water for a family. So when you run out, what do? People were out on lines when the military came in New York, was handing out water, and they're fighting on these lines, and you may not get the water you need. So you have to have some equipment, and this is the Gary Noel emergency filter equipment that can take non-potable water, that means water that may have germs in it, bacteria, and convert it to potable water by removing the bacteria, the debris. We saw a lot of debris in the water after Sandy for a year or more in the main pipes. It was in Staten Island, it was in Brooklyn. We're still seeing it. And if you have the equipment that you need, you'll never run out of water. You won't get die of lack of water because you have to have adequate amounts of water every day. And when you run out of your storage water, you have a piece of equipment, the Gary Noel emergency filter, that can take any water source and make it clean and potable. And what's unique is the filtration of bacteria and parasites because the ceramic outer part of the filter has been tested against E. coli, millions of E. coli. And this is where it stands out from other filters. When you have water that has E. coli, which is from human or animal waste, that can be lethal. That will kill you. So by filtering through the Gary Noel ceramic filter with a metal gun, it will remove the bacteria. It'll take out any of the contaminants, the chemicals, because you had chemicals coming up from the toxic waste sites getting into the water supply. So it'll take out that. It will remove all the heavy metals, and you have cleaner water than you can get from any other source when you need it. There's no other filters that I've reviewed, and there's several other filters that have been out there for years that don't match the performance of the Gary Noel emergency filter. So they will remove some bacteria and parasites, not to the level of the Gary Noel filter. They will not remove fluoride. They will not remove all the heavy metals. And when you drink water, even going through these other filters, it's still contaminated. So you have to have a Gary Noel filter in order to get the maximum filtration, to have a good water supply and continue to have a good water supply for an indefinite amount of time until the emergency is over. And even after that, when they start chlorinating the water, there's going to be a lot of chlorine and byproducts in the water. The filter still can be used to clean up the water. And it can be used on a daily basis for regular drinking water, cleaning up your water. So overall, it's a necessity to have it today because we're in hurricane season. 2018 is one of the worst years we've had for natural disasters in the United States. And I emphasize that this is a critical piece of equipment that you need to have.
I agree. We need to have clean water. And I challenge anyone out there to find me a water filter that has been more thoroughly tested and that can take more pollutants out of water than this emergency filter. It's just, to me, it's unfathomable with all this happening, all the crisis in the world, all the people who had fire in California. When you have a fire running through a community, it burns out the power lines. It burns out the power lines. You don't have electricity. You don't have water. Now you don't have any stores that have any. You have no gasoline in any of the stations. So people are acting like this is the first time that this is happening. It's not. And don't be one of the people who are waiting for Katrina. You just sit there and wait. It's like a deer in the headlights, like, I don't know what to do. Well, make the call. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Again, 877-627-5065 and ask for the Gary Noll water filter. I don't have a lot. I only have about 30 units. Because these are all handmade, and we'll get them out to you immediately. And if you live in Florida, we're going to get them out within 24 hours, because you're going to need them if you live in the areas where this hurricane's coming. And then in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, that storm's going right up there. I just saw the trajectory for one on the air. Roy, thank you again for coming on. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Gary.
Dr. Roy Spicer. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come back with our guest. Please stay with us. Okay. By the way, I did a webinar that's up on our website, What to Do When Emergency Strikes. It's 3 hours long. It's packed with information because people who never thought they would be in harm's way are now getting just slammed. And we are now in the chaos theory part of global warming, where there is no one who can accurately predict when we're going to have problems and what part of the world and to what degree it will manifest. So I've invited Charles Eisenstein on the air. I gave you his biographical information a little earlier, and he is the author of Climate, A New Story, which presents a new narrative, a new ethos on to the conversation we must begin in order to address and prepare ourselves for growing crisis due to climate change. His website is charleseisenstein.net. Nice to have you with us again, Charles.
Yeah, good to be back.
Charles, we have already heard by now the dire news from the most recent IPCC report, which says we have 12 years to diligently put our full attention in dealing with rapid climate change before it's too late. Today, a senior scientist at MIT reported that we cannot reverse climate change with negative emission technologies in response to the solutions being posed by the IPCC report. This would include biochar, CO2 capture and storage, direct air capture, geoengineering, ocean fertilization, chemical alkalinity of the oceans. Now, you've stated similarly and propose that we need to change our climate narrative dramatically. And it's not simply the scientific aspects that will enable a true Marshall Plan to get humanity to change course. It's also our personal relationship to the Earth, the climate and species, a new intellectual framework, as it were. At times, I believe that people live in complete denial of their responsibility. Somehow, someone's going to come and save them. The government, scientists, it's not going to happen. So are there good reasons for us to be fearful about humanity's future? And I had Guy McPherson on the air. I did a pre-record of 3 hours. We filmed him for a new documentary I'm working on the environment. Now, Guy has been one who was the canary in the coal mine. He was professor emeritus of environmental science at the University of Arizona. And he was ridiculed and mocked and attacked for telling the truth. And that was 7 years ago. He said we had 13 years. Now he tells me we don't have 13 years. We're going to start seeing major environmental impacts within the next 2 years, especially with the removal of ice in the Arctic. So he puts us back into a paradigmatic mindset that we've seen before, and which consists of fails. You know, we failed in the war on cancer, we failed in the war on drugs, we failed in the war on terrorism, we failed in the war on poverty. And he believes that we are now going to fail in the climate change war. The forum is yours. Give us your thoughts, please.
Yeah, thank you. Quite interesting to have me following Guy McPherson on this show. My perspective is quite different, although I affirm the basic alarm and urgency for the future of this planet. I think that the one commonality between the failure of the war on drugs, the war on poverty, the war on crime, the war on germs, the war on weeds, the war on terror, etc., and the war on climate change is perhaps the war framing to begin with that calls on our fear of survival, our fear of not surviving, of human extinction, to motivate us into action. And I think that the kinds of changes that we need to make to have a different future will not come from appealing even more strongly to self-interest. I think, and I don't want to sound too squishy here, but I think that we need to change to a love narrative, and that will allow us to make the kinds of courageous changes that only come from love. Part of the love narrative depends on seeing Earth as alive, and it harks back to the heyday of environmentalism back when I was a kid in the 1970s, when it was, for example, Save the Whales. And it wasn't because if the whales die, then bad things will happen to us. It was because the whales are beautiful and we love them. I want to extend that to the whole planet, because the crisis isn't only a crisis of the bad things that will happen to us. It is the dying of life on Earth, and it goes way beyond the effects of global warming. It includes what you might call ecocide. What I've learned in researching this book is that even if we cut emissions to zero overnight, if we continue to degrade the organs and tissues of this living being called Gaia, called planet Earth, if we continue to clear-cut the rainforests, strip mine, cultivate the soil and expose the soil to erosion, destroy the mangroves, drain the wetlands, overfish the oceans, kill the whales, and so on, then the Earth will still die a death of a million cuts. So sometimes I find that the focus on global warming as the defining issue of environmentalism leaves a lot of things out that are actually more important than we think, even from within the frame of global warming. And so this is both a cause for even greater alarm, but it's also a cause for hope and a new direction, because when we strengthen the living being on the organ and tissue level, protecting forests, regrowing forests, practicing regenerative agriculture, rebuilding soil, not only is the planet more resilient to the instability that increased greenhouse gases cause, but also these practices draw down carbon way faster than has been appreciated until recently. So it's kind of a win-win. And I guess this is like a big piece to chew that I'm just spewing out right now, but essentially I'm calling it as a first step or as a foundational step, a shift to a living planet view where we're not just motivated to save civilization, save humanity, but also to be in a caring, participatory, healing relationship with every being on this planet.
I appreciate and respect that perspective, Charles. I'd like to share a different one and see if this makes any sense to you. I believe that about 5% of the people in America and more around the world are doing exactly now and have been what you're suggesting. These are people coming from empathy, from love of other people, of other species, of the world. They take nothing for granted, not their health. They're living at the high end of their consciousness. Now look at the professional class. These are the policymakers, the lawyers, doctors, politicians, engineers, professors, architects, and the medical community. These are 17.2 million in number, with the average family size being a total of four. You're dealing with over 68 million people. Then you have your millionaire class, $1 million, not including real estate. That's another 40 million. That's 112 million Americans, or over one-third of the American population, live a life of hedonic decadence, seeking pleasure for pleasure, self, not because the pleasure could be shared in a constructive way, in a good way. And as a result, these people are confused about who they are. They can tell you their career and what they do for a living, and they generally have mastered that, but they're on that ladder. And that ladder is where they're going. They're not looking at the environment. They're still eating meat. They don't care about being a vegan. They don't question GMOs. They don't question 29 million, or yeah, about 29 million people are food insecure, or 19 million people are in food insecure in Libya and starving to death. They don't care about that. They don't care about regime change. They don't care about who's in the White House. They may or may not like a particular person, but they feel their career and their family and the immediacy of their life and pleasures is more important than the body politic. These are people who are not going to give up using straws, even as mandate, or plastic bags. They don't want to be involved. Now, if you take your major policy makers and opinion leaders, including those in the media, and you exclude them from your very, very positive suggestions, what you're left with are the disempowered, primary working class people and some idealists sprinkled through the rest of society. So how do you get people who right now didn't lift the finger to stop the war in Iraq, regime change in Syria, the destruction of Libya, and also didn't care about the consequences up to this point of helping anyone who suffered as a victim of environmental crisis, and they don't care about animals except their dogs and cats? How do you get them to be a part of your vision?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. I think that's a core issue. And it transcends political polarities, whether it's the Republicans or Democrats in this country. You know, who is talking about the 5 million Yemeni children who are on the brink of starvation at the hands of a U.S. ally? You know, who is talking about the effect of neoliberal economics as a generator of the refugee crisis? You know, who's talking about the genocide that's going on right now in Cameroon that no one knows about due to wanting to clear people out of the way for oil drilling? Like, there's a lot underneath the surface that nobody is paying attention to. And so my question, to really take it down to basics, is one of curiosity and not blame, saying, why is it that so many people are not in touch with their love and care for the earth? Why are so many people devoted to what you're calling them hedonic pleasures, but I see it as a symptom of disconnection? Like, and asking the question with real curiosity and empathy, like, why, what is missing from your life that instead of bringing real nourishment, real connection, real community, real intimacy with community and with nature, instead you're getting a McMansion and a yacht and a new car and whatever other substitutes you're bringing in for the missing, the real things in life. And how do we change that? Because I really see people fundamentally as wanting to be of service in this world, wanting to contribute to something larger than themselves, and harboring a deep love for the earth and for humanity. So I ask, what has cut us off from that? And here we get a connection between the Earth's climate and the political climate, the social climate, and the psychic climate, the consciousness of people individually and collectively. And when we understand that all these things are connected, then we no longer are in a war mentality when it comes to fighting climate change, which is a symptom of a much deeper malady. Like this rampant runaway consumerism, like what's that a symptom of? And if we can begin asking that question and addressing it on the causal level rather than the symptomatic level, then we can get somewhere. Because right now we're not getting anywhere. It's been, 25 years since the 1992, the original summit, where everybody agreed that they were going to cut carbon emissions and so on and so forth. And what has it been since then? It's like a 50, 70% increase in carbon emissions, despite everybody agreeing that they're going to cut them, and no end in sight. Whatever we're doing now isn't working. And that's why I'm advocating that we really examine the rhetoric and the strategy that we use, just because it's not working. Like, let's get underneath and ask, like we talk about an addiction to fossil fuel. Okay, do we mean, you're an addict in the kind of tone of blame and censure and how could you? Or are we understanding that addiction is a symptom of unmet needs and that it's no more fruitful to rhetorically yell at everybody saying how terrible you're addicted to oil than it is to go to an alcoholic and say, you better stop drinking or bad things are going to happen to your body and you're just going to have to try harder. Like, there is something else, a deeper level of transformation that needs to happen. And I think we got to begin looking at that. Otherwise, even if we use, geoengineering, et cetera, all these things that aren't going to be enough anyway to reduce carbon emissions, but we continue and hold a vision of sustainability that means to sustain what we have already, but with a different power source, our ruination of the planet will not stop. There will be other crises. We have to reconnect.
Charles, I commend you for the desire you have. I've looked at human nature. I can't get people in my entire career to stop killing themselves with forks and knives of what they eat. I can't get them to stop becoming part of a mob mindset in lemmings. And I think I understand why. And unfortunately, I believe that what will get our attention, what will cause a national, even a worldwide Marshall Plan, and quickly, is when there's going to be a disaster happening is so bad that it's like having a massive heart attack where you only are survived when they resuscitate you on the operating table. That gets your attention. I just don't believe that we've gotten everyone's attention, nor will we, because we are a culture that has mastered the art of distraction and living in denial. So if it takes a Category 5 hitting New York City to wake us up, if that's what wakes us up, or one of the great faults out there in the Pacific Rim causing a massive destruction, and nobody wants to see anyone suffer destruction. But my belief is only then will we say, okay, let's all go to work and stop pretending we're doing anything. As you said, we're not doing diddly squat. And because people, it's not an addiction to fossil fuels as much as an addiction to the products we make from fossil fuels, our a massive consumption society where we have to grow every year. And I believe that getting people to stop buying stuff is not an easy task. They want change, but not their own personal change. But you put someone into a crisis where they cannot avoid the crisis. They're in it. Like right now, North Carolina, they're in it. In northern Florida, they're in it. In Texas and Houston with 21 trillion gallons of water in that week last year, they're in it. They got a reality check, but we have to have one that we all recognize. We got to start. No more excuses. Do it. And I hope that that is not the case. I just fear that it is. Final thought from you, please.
Well, you know, if we're going to use the addiction metaphor, that might be called hitting bottom. And yeah. If that's what it takes to put us into back into relationship with the parts of life that we have excluded from self. But, you know, a lot of people, especially in the elite, we have whole systems that insulate us from what's happening out there. And perhaps, like, I'm not sure if a crisis will save us. I think that something else has to happen in our perception of the world, where we no longer see and treat the world as an other, but understand it to be a part of ourselves. And to build new systems on top of that.
I hope you're right. Charles, I hope you're right. I would much rather have your outcome than the one that I see. You know, but the reality is you're asking for a spiritual renaissance, a catharsis of individual attunement to a higher level of ethics, to the world,
to
each other.
That is translated into systems. For example, you talked about the runaway consumption. The runaway growth. It's not just asking people to consume less. It's also changing a system that only works in the context of endless growth. So we're getting into the dynamics of a debt-based financial system. That if you don't change that, then the pressure for growth to turn some part of nature into product or some relationship into a service will be relentless.
I agree. Charles, we're out of time. Thank you very much for coming on. Charles Eisenstein, and he is the author of Climate, A New Story. I'm Gary Nall. Please pay attention to the environment. Become proactive, because you never know when that crisis could be at your door. Have a nice day, everyone.
My baby loves me, oh yeah. My baby needs me.